take this valuable time to ask
questions.
Some questions.
Sir?
Yes, I have a question. Supposedly, or maybe it's a word request. supposing that I wanted to identify with this inclusive coalition in some easy way, I'm assuming that I would call myself a publicist, although I'm currently identifying as an environmentalist.
Good point.
That would seem to be a good starting point for people that want to take a low level to associate themselves with this movement group. Do you have any recommendations?
That's a great question. I think commoner sounds kind of attractive. I mean, I come from Britain, but communist, I think, is a very bad idea for a variety of reasons. That's a very good question. I have to say there is no neat phrase, but there should be. And I invite all of you to send me your email suggestions. A small but valuable prize will be mailed to the winner. No, I really, seriously, I think it's a very important thing, because you do have to name it in a way that allows people to say, what is it that I do? Right now we have people who say, I care about the public domain, or I'm not an intellectual property maximalist. And that's, you know, hard to get on a banner. So I think you raise a good point.
Just a couple of thoughts. Something that surprised me a couple of years ago was the lack of sort of persistent public anger over maps. But I wonder if maybe going forward 10, 20, 30 years, the kids who can't share files as freely as they would like to, when they move into positions of power, are going to be much more receptive to arguments.
Right.
The other thing that made you a little less optimistic is the analogy with the estate tax and trying to get authors to buy into Creative Commons.
Yeah.
Who wants to be a millionaire? Everybody does. You know, people have no hope of ever sheltering their wealth from an estate tax and become passionate supporters of the one that destroys the children so drastically in your country. Is there a danger of that happening with authors? Can we get authors to dedicate their works in some fashion?
Let me start with that one, which is absolutely true, and a lot of people say that. A lot of people say, for me to take the act of dedicating my work to the public domain would feel like, and they feel this quite passionately, that I was saying it was worthless, because that's one of the other images of the public domain. The public domain is just a bunch of trash, you know, Shakespeare and Mozart and Einstein, you know, just a bunch of trash. And which is actually how the recording industry and motion picture industry has literally referred to it. The public domain's a bunch of stuff that nobody wants. That's how they refer to it. So I think there is a problem, and there is this image of, as you said, of people saying, well, I also want this long copyright term, because maybe I'll be the next, you know, J.D. Salinger or what have you. When we started Creative Commons, we went through a very big internal debate about what kinds of licenses we should offer and which would be kind of the highest or most, you know, honorable or virtuous. And a lot of people didn't want to put in the restrictions which we currently have, allowing you to say, no, you can't use it at all for commercial use, you know, or, you know, you have to give attribution and so forth. And by talking to artists and authors and filmmakers and so forth, those of us who believed that the restrictions were very important were able to win the day, because it turned out that while they might not be willing to say, I give up my work completely, I dedicate it to the public domain, they were very willing to say, I do actually want people to be free to use a bit of my movie in their movie, provided I get credit, or a chunk of my song, or to use my calculus module in their class. That, it turns out, was a great wedge to drive into it. And then when they saw the benefits they got it, because they get the nice email from the person who's using it, or the return in terms of, you know, prestige or fame or what have you, then I think they get more excited by it. So that's the answer to that. In terms of the Napster question, I think the response to Napster was, it was something that everybody wanted to do, and a large number of people thought that the economics of the music industry were themselves unjust, even if it were the law that what they were doing was illegal, which was a disputed question. But they never felt a sense of entitlement to it. And so when it was taken away, it was rather like the free donuts being taken away, or, you know, the pizza that it was great when it was there, and we really loved it. And what's more, we think that's the kind of thing they should have done for us, but it's not like it's ours, right? And so I think that's why there was this complete, you know, this intense usage, which was actually getting Congress's attention. You had more Napster users than registered voters in the United States by a considerable number. Okay? That's not hard, of course, but I think what needs to happen is in areas that don't trigger people's, yeah, well, it was fun, but you know, even though I think the music industry sucks, I must admit I'm not really entitled to it. You need people to have more of an experience where it's not just the sharing of files, although I think that's important, but something where they also have this sense of vestedness and entitlement, right, where they actually have a sense of this is mine and you're taking it away from me. That, I think, was missing in the Napster area, although I've talked to a lot of younger people who do share the view that you put forward, namely, this just showed us how totally screwed up the law is and why we have no respect for it.
Yes. How does the
Well, I think, I mean, on one level you could say, and the lawyer's answer is, well, they're totally separate legal fields, but of course the same attitude towards property rights pervades all of them, namely, more property is good. And what's more, if you think of the public domain as a kind of area which is protected by retaining walls from the forces of property, what we see is the erosion of those retaining walls. So we allow copywriting of things that we wouldn't have done before, patenting of just ludicrous things, business methods, and so forth. And in the cases of genes, the old rule of intellectual property, which is a great idea, the old conception, which sadly never seems to get explained. This is what I would explain to kindergartners instead of teaching them that they're all thieves. I would teach them a little about the public domain. The conception is, you can't own facts, and you can't own ideas. But people can make things with facts and ideas that come out as expression, a novel, or as invention, a drug, and you can own those. But facts below and ideas above must always be free. Okay? What the gene patents did is essentially to give someone an intellectual property right over what was really a fact about nature. CGAGGCCA. And I think in doing so, it caused a lot of people to realize there was a problem because there's some real question about whether or not that slowed down some development because there are these blocking patents where people can't actually engage and can't license and so forth. That decision has been made, and I don't think it could be undone without literally destroying the biotechnology industry, because the venture capital world took, probably wrongly, but took patents as a signifier for potential future capital value. And when Tony Blair and Clinton said, well, you know, maybe we shouldn't have gene patents, you know, the NASDAQ goes down like a stone. So I think the same, to answer your question, the same idea is operating in both. There are similar problems, namely going beyond where IP should go. In that case, I think it's a fait accompli, and I think efforts at reform have to come at it from the other end by creating research exemptions, mandatory licenses, and so forth.
But I think that's an area where people are hustling when you actually connect with the environmental movement.
Yeah. And I've written about this. I've written about it, and it does get a great response. Here's my own auto-critique of myself on this. The problem with that is not that it's not a rich concept, it's that it's too rich a concept. Because what you get there is a very interesting set of responses. You can't patent it because it's sacred, you know, because God wrote those. God wrote those CGs and Ts. You're a plagiarist, right, when you claim to own them. You can't own it for environmental reasons. You can't own it. And it's a very different set of cluster of things. Now, I'm in favor of umbrella groups, but many of those feelings don't pass over when you come to things like the DMCA or business method patents and so forth. And so it gets people interested, but I don't know if it sustains a large enough group. Sir?
First, I have been a member of California State far longer than I've not been a member in my life. And I work in the commercial entertainment and digital media industries, and I have long dialogues with myself about the issues you've just addressed. I know Larry Lessig, and I've seen that side of it, and I've also worked in the commercial entertainment industry. And I want to salute you for the true virtuosity of your presentation. I think it's just magnificent. Having said that, and it's just very good, as an end virtuoso performance, there's so much to comment on and to react to, but I would like to focus on a couple of things. First of all, when you talk about the idea of property versus, say, a process, at the very top of your remarks, I think Whitehead's fallacy of misplaced concreteness, you know, that we make an expression into a thing. And I think that the ecology of the intellect, I think is also a very rich and resourceful idea. The comment that going out 50 years, 98% of the copyrights are worthless, would be very compelling, but for the fact that the Bono Extension Act makes it 75 years. Why would anybody care? And the answer is, Bugs Bunny. Mm-hmm. And I represented Chuck Jones. And I once said to Chuck, who was one of the co-creators of Bugs Bunny, I said, Chuck, are you ever surprised at the popularity of the characters you've created and co-created? And he said, Harvey, I'm amazed. I'm constantly astounded. You would be insane if you weren't. Indeed, I submit respectfully that the big three oligopoly of intellectual property owners who seek to own more, namely AOL, Time Warner, Disney, and Viacom, are deriving the majority of their revenues from those 2 or 3%. How much is Walt Disney's Snow White worth? That motion picture is priceless. And so what happens is a very weird thing. And the other thing that I think we need to bear in mind also that I feel very much, because I've been working with academia, and the ideas that you express I find more common in academia than in at Disney, Warner Brothers, or Viacom, is the fact that many of the expressors of these views have tended. Now, in the entertainment industry where I have managed to survive for a quarter of a century, we have what's called the opposite of tenure. It's called, there is always a bullet at maximum velocity, 2 inches from the base of your skull. Okay? And therefore, the arguments of those with tenure to those who are in that world is a hard one to make, but for the bridge that you made in the ecology. The ecology of thought. The other thing that I would ask you to reflect upon is this, and this is where I'm going personally, and then I'll be quiet and invite any comment you might choose to have, is that I've come to the conclusion that the Anglo-American system of jurisprudence fails. It fails because it is adversarial. It's adversarial, unlike, say, the Japanese system of jurisprudence, which is de-adversarializing. So in the impulse, the default to property, to make property out of expressions of ideas, the movement away from your simple but profound explanation to the kindergartner, idea, fact, expression of idea, perfect. It's eloquent growth, right? Okay, why do we propertize? Because we are adversarial. In order to have property, there has to be a you and a me. And you can't have what I made, okay, because I'm me, and I'm a lawyer who I've hired to fight with your lawyer. They both make money, and to protect me from you. Okay, now, in the effort to de-adversarialize the legal profession, I've run into absolutely fascinating opposition, and I believe that Professor Lessig has tenure. I hope that you have tenure. All the other people I know in the movement either have tenure or are getting the credit. And so when we're talking about building an ecology like the environmental movement, I think that might be on the right track. But it also has to think through and make contact with those who are now starving, dying, crying, and whining about the annihilation of their careers as a result of the invasion of the digital media.
Very rich set of comments, and I'll respond very briefly, and maybe we can continue it afterwards. First, on the percentages, it is true, of course, that some of the works, that of course there are people who derive great value from things like copyright term extension. You know, Mickey Mouse is a good example. Bugs Bunny. First point is, I would be personally much happier if we simply passed an appropriation bill and conveyed monopoly rents to Mickey Mouse and Bugs Bunny in order to give them the money that they would have, and then said, you know what, the other 99%, which was totally, is free. Everybody can use it. That's a much more rational system. If you want to just talk about that kind of system, right, even assuming the incentive to create were there, which it isn't, it's being created, right, but if that's the idea that somehow we had this income stream in the past, I'm entitled to it in the future, which is a kind of tenure, I think, actually. Right, so if that were the idea, then I think the way we're doing it is dumb. Okay. Second point, in fact, most of the ways that the big companies make money from their old stuff would exist even with a copyright term of more reasonable proportions. Trademark, for example, would be an enormous source of value over things like Snow White and Mickey Mouse, and as you know very well, trademark doesn't expire. So, you know, so this image, yes, it's true, you can say we get this much from this, but how much of that is actually exploiting the expression? So I just, if you look at the figures, it turns out that I think one can challenge your assertion. Finally, the third point about adversarialness and property. Yes, property has a mine and thine, and actually I think even in Japan, the sort of mine and thine. I think here what we have to do for public discourse is something that lawyers learn in law school, which is you come in thinking you know what property is, and by the end of the first semester of law school, you don't even know that you own your own sneakers. Because what they teach you is you don't, there's not a thing called property, there's a bundle of rights, which we divide up in little different ways. Maybe the right to sell we'll give you, but not the right to throw away, right? We need to do that to the public, get them to see property as a bundle of rights in order to avoid the fallacy of misplaced concreteness, the reification that you described. We should, well, yeah, I mean, I should probably sit down, shouldn't I? Because I don't want to let people get by.
Howard,
at the back.
Yeah, Howard and then Noah.
Given what you said about changing the way the normal person thinks about these things and trying to build the movement, why are we using the word intellectual property? I mean, that seems absurd. I mean, a much more apt word would be monopoly, because that's what these things are. And that would get away from things like statements that I think Blackfoot's supposed to say that Snow White, you know, is property, and that it grins. I mean, that it belongs to Disney. That's absurd. That would really get away from the kind of thing that Brad Schroeder or Leary Rosen or Chad Valenti say, property is property, and therefore there's an ownership here, and move it more into what it is. It's a monopoly.
Yeah.
It's a government granted monopoly for some period.
That's absolutely right. That's the speech that I didn't give, is, you know, talking about the linguistics of it. One reason, however, to use the term at least sometimes is if you're using the term monopoly and they're using the term intellectual property, which they're not going to give up, right, then at some point you may actually just completely fail to connect, so that the public may be convinced by your argument in some sense, loosely understanding it, but don't even understand that it is in some sense opposed to their argument. There has to be a meeting point. So what I was trying to do in my remarks today was, so to speak, concede everything to the other side, right? Give them the term property, accept that the enclosure movement worked for arable land, not necessarily true, you know, accept that commonses are often badly run, not always true, right? And even show that even assuming arguendo, as lawyers say pretentiously, all of those things, they're still wrong. Okay, so, but I completely agree with you.
Mine's a very short question. I have students who are passionate about the environmental movement and passionate about social justice and passionate about intellectual property or the commons of the mind. And the ones who are passionate about social justice go and work for NYFERC over the summer, and the ones who are passionate about ecology go and, you know,
Well, we're working on that. I mean, I think what we need, we have a copyright clearinghouse. We need a public domain clearinghouse. But what we have got just is actually there are student fellowships. We have some at the Center for the Study of the Public Domain. EPIC, which I work with, has wonderful ones. IPIOP, called IPIOP, which they work, among other things, on digital rights management issues. EFF has a fabulous set of internships. There are these clinics, Pam Samuelson. But you're right, that needs to be advertised more broadly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.